Welcome to the sixth episode of the QICAG podcast. I'm your host, April Dinwiddie, communications consultant for the QICAG. With the six key messages as a guide, this podcast will highlight the practical tools, materials, and content created by the QICAG and offer a deeper understanding of how it can all be useful for members of the child welfare community, as well as allied professionals and parents. Today, we welcome Ryan Hanlon, Vice President of Education, Research, and Constituent Services at the National Council for Adoption. We're going to have a conversation today about the importance of ensuring the availability of and access to services and supports for families that adopt via intercountry or private domestic. Welcome to the podcast, Ryan.
I'm glad to be with you, April.
So the message we are focusing on today is one that is making sure that when we are offering and making services accessible to families, we are not just focused on families that adopt from foster care, but also including families that have adopted via intercountry or private domestic. Why do you think this is so important to highlight?
Well, these adoptive families can experience some of the same challenges of families who adopt through the child welfare system. It's important to remember that all children who have been adopted have suffered a loss, and it's not uncommon for children, especially those adopted via the intercountry process, to have also experienced varying degrees of trauma. As a result, these children can exhibit some of the same behaviors that children do who are adopted from the child welfare system.
Right. It's such a key point that you make, Ryan. And, you know, adoption, no matter how it happens, can have an impact on children and their adoptive families. So keeping this in mind, why is it critical for the child welfare system to keep these families in mind for their post-adoption services?
Well, historically, these families have had difficulty accessing adoption-competent services. And when they have found these services, they often come at a hefty fee in such a way that they actually become prohibitive for families to be able to access these services. Free services are often provided through the child welfare system, and those are not always accessible to families who adopt via the intercountry or private domestic process. And when they are, that availability varies significantly from state to state.
That's also another key point that you make. Why do you think there's such a variation in how state child welfare systems offer services to families?
In part, I think this has to do with conventional wisdom and some closely held beliefs of the past, where there was, and in some cases still is, the idea that families that adopt via the public system inherently need more help than families that adopt via intercountry and private domestic. And that's simply not true.
Right. That thinking has persisted, and coupled with the ideas that those who adopt privately may have more resources at their disposal and that love is enough, can further complicate things. Is any of this shifting, Ryan?
Fortunately, experience and research is showing us that there's now more of a recognition that trauma, grief, and loss are present, and there's a better understanding of what families need related to the realities of adoption, regardless of the type of adoption. We're seeing the need to be more intentional and to ensure that services and supports are available post-finalization for all families that provide permanence through adoption.
Yeah, absolutely, Ryan. Can you give folks a basic understanding of the differences in access to services and supports post-finalization for intercountry, private domestic, and the public system?
Of course, April. So the public system of adoption, the adoptions from the child welfare system, is the most uniform of the three when it comes to post-adoption service and support provision. And what I mean by that is, although the duration, the frequency, even the vitality of those services can change or vary from state to state, there is a baseline of services where these children almost always have access to free medical services, and they are almost always able to access some post-adoption services from the child welfare system at no cost. And that's not the case in most situations for families that adopt private domestic or through the intercountry system.
Okay, so what happens?
In those situations, we're relying on parents' medical insurance to access medical care, and the availability of services depends on the private agency they have and the location where they reside. There's no guarantee of these services, and the variability changes from family to family and from agency to agency.
So while all families may not need these services and supports, couldn't all families ultimately benefit from having the access to these quality adoption competent services post-finalization?
Exactly. Professionals and parents are now seeing the impact that trauma, separation, grief, and loss can have on a child, regardless of the type of adoption, and therefore more attention is being paid to supporting parents adopting from the public, the private and the intercountry system.
Yeah. It gets me thinking about the things we prefer not to see with adoption. You know, so right along with the benefits of adoption, we also have to see the challenges. Can you share some insights related to this?
Sure. Let me start by saying this. Most adoptees, regardless of adoption type, are physically and emotionally healthy. Adopted children are more likely than non-adopted children to experience significant physical health problems or have difficulties with emotions, concentration, and behavior.
Yes, understood. Can you say more here?
Most often, this increased risk is due to adoptees' exposure prior to the adoption. It's due to their exposure to adverse experiences that they had before they joined their adoptive family. But children who are adopted through intercountry and private domestic processes are likely to have been exposed to many of the same adverse childhood experiences as children adopted through the public welfare system, and therefore are likely to have needs similar to those families who adopt from the public child welfare system. That's the reason it's so important to ensure the services we have are available to all the families who need them.
Exactly. And as a baseline, we also have to acknowledge the realities of grief, loss, and trauma that are often embedded in the experiences of adoption, regardless of how it occurs, which is what we were just talking about in terms of the trauma piece. What are some of the specific challenges that might be part of adopting a child from another country?
Well, let me say a few things that come to mind. First, there's often incomplete or inadequate information about the child, including the medical condition or the child's birth history. Second is the trend we're seeing, which is that more and more children placed for adoption in other countries are older, they have a medical special need of some sort, or they're part of a sibling group, meaning more than one child's placed with a family at a time.
This is all so important, Ryan. What else?
Additionally, it's not uncommon for children to have lived in some type of institutional setting, such as an orphanage. In that setting, they're going to have experienced multiple caregivers and oftentimes will experience neglect or abuse. It's also common for children adopted internationally to have been exposed to environmental toxins, malnutrition, or to have some other adverse circumstance or experience.
And with all of this, Ryan, what can we do?
For all of these reasons, we want to ensure that we are specifically and proactively inviting these families into our support network. We want to see that they have ongoing connection and ongoing support.
Absolutely. And everything you share here is so important and critical. And then there are the added layers of what can be racial and cultural language differences that can be present in all types of adoption, but especially for families who adopt via the intercountry process.
Yes, absolutely, April. So the typical issues that we see with adoption, and by that I mean bonding, attachment, separation, grief, loss, identity formation, those typical issues can often be confounded by cultural differences, language barriers, and the challenges that can arise from differences in race and ethnicity. And when I say confounded, I mean they might be misunderstood or they might be obscured or perhaps they might be magnified in some way. The recognition that there's these combination of factors that families are grappling with and families are responding to is such that we should be even more intentional. It just makes sense that we are more intentional for these families to include them in the post-adoption services that were provided. And that's going to be very true for families that adopt via private domestic or intercountry, along with families that adopt from the public system. We don't want to be leaving any of these families out. We want to ensure that they have access to services and we're not telling them they have to fend for themselves.
Absolutely. You know, knowing this complexity does exist for families and then the access to the clinical interventions and support services to ensure the adoption stability, enhance the behavioral health of the adopted children, as well as the general family well-being is often limited for intercountry and private domestic adoptive families. I was so encouraged to know that the Children's Bureau, through the QICAG, intentionally targeted this population of families.
That's right, April. So in addition to targeting families that adopted from the public system, almost all of the QICAG sites specifically identified, targeted, and recruited families that had adopted via intercountry or private domestic. And by ensuring that those families were targeted for outreach, that not only helped those families that may have needed support, it also sends a more universal message about the importance of support, regardless of how the adoption comes about.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Ryan, it's one thing to recognize the importance of offering supports to these families, and yet another to conduct the outreach and engage them and get them involved. What are some of your thoughts here?
That's right. So with the desire to engage and offer the QICAG interventions, different sites had to be very intentional about identifying families and then put in the effort of conducting outreach.
Got it. So it's one thing to have the desire to engage these families, but it can be difficult, right?
Although it can be harder to find these families to offer preventative services, the QICAG sites found some interesting ways to engage private agencies that handled these adoptions so that they could then reach out to their families. Additionally, there are also a lot of online support groups that these families can access, and those settings can be a helpful way of getting the word out about services we're offering.
Okay, so how did the intentional focus on private domestic and intercountry adoption impact the work of the QICAG?
Working to engage this population reminded many of the QICAG teams that thoughtful strategy, planning, partnering, and committing to ongoing outreach is needed to connect with families so that they can know that services exist.
Yeah. So given all that we know, this makes so much sense. And I can imagine that these efforts to engage and involve these families paid off. Is that true?
Well, it has paid off. And while there's still a lot of work to be done, the families that did connect to services reaped the benefits. I think of one parent that participated in the AGES program, the Adoption and Guardianship Enhanced Support Program. That parent shared that it helped to find the right counseling for their kids. Another parent noted that AGES helped them gain access to resources and information that they might as a parent not have come across otherwise. That same parent said that before participating in AGES, they had to rely on online resources and word of mouth only. Parents are pleased when they can get access to lists of counselors and when they have an ability to reach out for additional services. Another parent noted that the questions from their AGES worker gave them a framework. It forced them to sit down and review the things that they needed to talk about and to work through. And they found that encouraging. And I find all of these stories encouraging. That's the reason these teams were set up and these interventions are working for these families. The QICAG interventions that reach the public, the private, and the intercountry systems are working. And that's the encouragement that that I've seen from the results of this project.
Right. It's such a good way to end the podcast on such an encouraging note. And I will note to listeners that you can find out about all the interventions on the QICAG website. And I want to thank you, Ryan, for your work, for your commitment, and for joining us today to share your thoughts on this topic. Thank you so much.
Thank you, April. It's been nice talking with you.
Today, we know that all adoptive families can benefit from adoption competent services. While love may indeed be the most important ingredient, post-adoption services that serve to ensure adoption stability and enhance the behavioral health of the adopted child as well as the general family well-being go hand in hand in playing a critical role for all families that provide permanence. The QICAG was funded through the Department of Health and Human Services, Administration for Children and Families, Children's Bureau, grant number 90CO1122-0100. The contents of this podcast do not necessarily reflect the views or the policies of the funders, nor does mention of trade names, commercial products, or organizations imply the endorsement by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. This information is in the public domain.